To see examples of what we talked about on this episode, along with further information, go to bunchofdorks.com.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to
Two Dimension Podcast,
the comic book podcast
with no direction.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Two Dimension Comics, the podcast with no direction. This is episode number 181. Not to be confused with The Incredible Hulk number 181, which is the first full appearance of Wolverine. Len Wein had nothing to do with this episode. I'm your host, Dallas.
That we know of.
Not yet, anyway. He may have created Rook.
He may have written one of our books.
That's true. Anyway, I'm Dallas. I'm your host. And with me, we have...
Don.
Al.
How are we not doing a Len Wein episode?
I know.
That would be awesome.
You know, I'm going to say something.
That's Rook, by the way.
On Len Wein. Dallas worked at the widget factory.
Oh, my God.
And he said, I was listening to a podcast called Fanboy Radio. It's a really good show. They always interview people. And I knew Dallas. We'd always talk about rock bands, you know, different stuff like that. And I was telling a friend of mine about Fanboy. He says, Len Wein was on it. And I was trying to explain who he was. And I said, this is the guy. He co-created Swamp Thing, you know, co-created Wolverine, wrote the new X-Men, you know, when that started. I was just going on about all this stuff. And a Dallas walked by and goes, you talking about Len Wein? How do you know Len Wein? And that's where the friendship started.
And the rest is history.
Yeah. Recorded history. You can check our backlog of recorded episodes at bunchofdorks.com. Yeah. And just
click on the Cyclops. And is this where the end music runs now?
But is it over already? I don't know this episode. But no, writers were never something I gave much thought to. I always bought books for the artist. I mean, I would like stories. But you'd always see certain names, and eventually I'd hear one of them being interviewed, like Marty Pascal, you know, Len Wein, Marv Wolfman. I never gave a thought to what their contribution was. But yeah, Len Wein is actually one of my favorites.
Swamp Thing, oh God! Like you said, everything you said before the Wolverine stuff. He came out of the same kind of era as Wrightson, Jones, Kaluta, and all those guys. But I think he ended up going to DC pretty early on, writing for the horror books like Tales of the Unexpected and all that stuff. So he was kind of doing a lot of the short stories and stuff like that. But then he went on to do the superhero work, and he made a big name for himself. Swamp Thing was the thing that really got
him. I think it was. And then he wrote Giant Size X-Men number 1. Yeah. And then from there, passed it on.
Did he create the characters?
He co-created, probably with Cockrum, Dave Cockrum. He co-created most of the characters from the all-new, all-different X-Men.
Because they still had the ones from the old X-Men,
They did.
I mean, not Wolverine. Cyclops and Jean Grey.
Cyclops, Jean Grey, Beast, Iceman, and Angel.
Right.
So, and, Wein wrote Giant Size X-Men number 1, and then starting with issue 94 of Uncanny X-Men, that's when the all-new, all-different X-Men actually continued from Giant Size. Wein plotted issues 94 and 95, but it was scripted by Chris Claremont. And then starting with issue 96 on, it was just Claremont.
Oh, I didn't know it was that soon.
Me neither.
Well, what the deal was with Wolverine, Len Wein said that they were always talking about making X-Men and, you know, bringing it back. Roy Thomas is one, too. And they were going to make an international cast. And they were talking about how there's certain countries that, you know, Marvel books sold really well. So they were wanting to put a character from those countries.
Yeah.
And Len Wein started thinking about it. So that's when he had Wolverine. And he put him from Canada, hoping that maybe he'd be in the X-Men book. Dave Cockrum came over from DC. Storm, Nightcrawler, and Colossus were supposed to be in the Legion of Superheroes. He had designs for it and all that. And then when he left DC, he just brought him over and put him in the new X-Men. I remember Len Wein joked that nobody bothered to research what countries the Marvel books were selling well. So I remember they took Banshee. I think...
Scotland, Irish.
Yep. Wow.
Now, Sunfire. Was Sunfire around before?
Yeah, he was in, issue 62 or 63 or something of Uncanny X-Men. So he showed up before Giant Size. he's one of the guys, just like Banshee, who is, I want to say, issue 28 of X-Men. They just grabbed those guys from the old X-Men lore just because they were international
the
characters.
The Indian character was Warhawk.
Warpath.
Warpath.
No, no. Thunderbird.
Warpath. Yeah, Warpath is his little brother that came later on in the X... was it X-Force? Or did he show up in New Mutants?
He showed up in Uncanny X-Men issue 193.
Okay.
I think.
But that was a new character.
Yep. Thunderbird was a new character.
And then you have a sister later on in the New Mutants, another female Native American character.
They weren't related, but they did have a Native American character in New Mutants.
1982 Len Wein.
Oh, there you go.
Oh, we've got to put this picture. We got 1982 Len Wein looking like kind of a baller. We got to put him on our website.
Yeah, we got
to
put that on.
Send that pic to Don.
Len Wein and Marv Wolfender, they were early fanzine guys. They were writing for fanzines.
And they were friends too, right? So they were helping each other out in the industry.
They were helping each other out. And then Wein went to do Swamp Thing, and Wolfman went to Marvel and did Tomb of Dracula.
Yes.
Or, yeah, the Dracula book or whatever. So that's where they got their starts or whatever. But, yeah, they came out of that whole new... Like back in the late 60s, early 70s, all the new blood came in. Because when you think about it, all the guys that have been around since the Golden Age or whatever, were getting, you know, into their 60s or
they were getting
50s.
On where they could, not all of them could see very well or
well,
draw.
He's 68 now, so.
Yeah, there you go. And he was recently in the hospital. He was ill, but I think he's better now. So, yeah, there were the new people that came out and came out of the fan era. And they kind of set the template for what goes on. You know, now you do the fan work and then you come in and you become professional. You know people, whatever. But yeah, and of course, they were all in New York, so they were right in the vicinity of Marvel and stuff like that. And Wein was actually an artist too, because I know what issue it is, I have to find it. In an issue of Creepy, you know, ding, 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 he actually did an illustration of all some of the Uncle Creepy and Eerie, and it was actually pretty nice. Is it on the blog?
Yeah, because you talked about it one time. We showed it to him, and we put it on one of the posts.
Really nice art too.
It's funny too. Marv Wolfman went on to write the Teen Titans, which in the Bronze Age was kind of DC's version of X-Men.
Because it was the junior characters or whatever. Yeah. All the kid characters or whatever.
And I guess, and what I mean by that is thematically, they were similar, and I've heard a lot of people point out just the focus was more on character drama, almost soap opera style melodrama.
I always thought that the Doom Patrol was kind of like.
And I would say Silver Age Doom Patrol,
Fantastic
Silver Age
X-Men. X-Men.
Yeah, that's very similar style. That's why I said the Bronze Age version of the X-Men. Like Claremont's X-Men and Wolfman's new Teen Titans were kind of similar.
Because Doom Patrol and the original Teen Titans were a little bit different, but they were definitely like. The Teen Titans are almost like the back in the days when they had the kids legions or whatever.
Yeah, well, you're talking
like
about
the sidekick.
I'm talking
Legion of Justice.
Yeah, the kid superheroes or whatever. Yeah. They were bringing that back or whatever. But you're talking about. See the ages are kind of weird. It's like when does the Silver Age end? 1970.
When they fired Gardner Fox.
When did they fire him? Do you remember?
When Jack Kirby left Marvel and went to DC, that was the end of the Silver Age.
That's the Bronze Age.
Yeah.
So the Bronze Age is from like 70 or 71 till 80 something or other.
Yeah, see, to me, I thought that it ended by the 80s, but it doesn't. It goes up to like...
I think the Bronze Age is still the 90s. Sorry,
is
I'm
it really?
Yelling.
Is it really into the 90s? Okay.
I thought it was in
I would think because the modern age that we're in, I'm pretty sure that's just 21st century, I would assume. I think Rook's going to look it up for us, though.
Silver Age is considered a period of time from 1956 to 1970. It was succeeded by the Bronze Age and the Modern Age.
What are the Bronze Age?
Bronze Age of comic books. Well, let's take a look. I'm surprised the Silver Age started so
it was
early.
That was when the showcase.
Yeah, I would consider when they put the Flash, the Barry Allen Flash.
I didn't know that came out so early. I thought that was like 59 or 60.
That was the rebirth of superheroes.
Yeah. That's right.
A much shorter time frame. Bronze Age was considered between 1970 to 1985.
Oh, I'm totally wrong then. So, damn.
It went in the 80s to me.
So the modern age has lasted, what, 30 years?
but if you think about it, it was in the late 80s where they started mass running. I mean, take a look at the books from the 80s. The late half of the 80s, those books aren't worth much. You know?
New Warriors, X-Force, stuff like that, right? Or was that early 90s?
No, that's early 90s. So... You know, late '80s, you're talking about like some of the later X-Men stuff.
Before... New Mutants. The Australia X-Men.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah. The Australia X-Men.
Shut up. I like it.
but even like New Mutants, there's only key issues that are worth much.
First appearance of the characters.
Yeah, pretty much. Or deaths of characters.
That's because they printed some in.
Oh,
them.
Poor Doug.
Everybody.
You know, but if you look at it, if you look at some of the gold, silver, bronze age stuff, you know, Yancey Street happened to pull a collection recently that, let me tell you, there's a gorgeous Don and Al, if we go up there later, I'll see if I can sneak you guys in the back room. But there's a long box, a short box, and then a small stack of just Golden Age.
Nice.
So, I mean, my God. You know, this is a beautiful collection that he just got.
You gotta wonder how much he paid for something like that.
I didn't even look at half of what he had there, because it's like, to me, it was kind of like, ooh, okay, I can't afford to be touching these things.
Yeah.
Right? No, that's cool, though.
Golden Age is always weird to me, because you liked them, but I remember when I was a kid, I would buy like a giant size 25-cent comic book, and they had a few new stories. But then at the end, they would have a bunch of Golden Age stories. Yeah. And to me, it was always like, not all of it, but at that time, to my eyes, it was crude art, so I was never really into it. You know, even though it was the first appearance.
It was comic book art for the time. Yeah. You know?
And I loved them. I love those old stories. DC was doing that. Again, when the Bronze Age started, when Jack Kirby left Marvel and went to DC, the way people explain the ages is it started when Julius Swartz started at... DC and did, you know, him and Gardner Fox brought back the Flash.
Oh, okay.
And then
the Flash of Two Worlds,
the Silver Age. I think Marty Pascal said this on Word Balloon. The Silver Age basically ended when Jack Kirby left Marvel and went to DC. But DC got rid of
Gardner Fox,
and they got rid of John Broom. What was the other writer?
John Broom was another writer. Yeah,
they were gone, and they said that was the beginning of the Bronze Age.
Oh, okay. Yeah, because Gardner Fox then started working on short stories every once in a while, but they were never really...
Who's the dude that drew Superman in the Silver Age?
Kurt Swan.
That was kind of a defining Silver Age era.
Yeah, but he continued on.
He continued.
It was in 86 when John Byrne took over Superman and Action Comics, and Alan Moore wrote those two stories, Whatever Happened to Man of Tomorrow, and it was the last issue of Superman, the last issue of Action Comics. And Kurt Swan drew it, and George Perez inked it. That was really nice.
Kurt Swan was still working into the 90s, early 90s. I'm not sure when he passed away, but he was still working. So he was like...
He's prolific.
Especially on Superman. He had a long run on that book, and, you know, like a few others in there. But yeah, it's kind of weird how the ages were. Definitely the Silver Age was the beginning of superheroes.
But what's interesting is I'm reading an article here that they consider the beginning of the modern age one of the books that signifies... the beginning of the modern age of comics was Watchmen.
Well, that makes sense, because time-wise, that was 1986, and you said...
Yep.
Yeah, you said that they consider the Bronze Age ending in 85, so yeah. Okay.
So 86, herald in with the start of Watchmen.
Yeah, we're still in the modern age?
Yes. Mm. Yeah. That's
a long time.
Yeah.
I know, I feel like when they do change an age, though, like, they have to... They can't call that the modern age.
They can't really call this the postmodern age.
There you go.
But if you think about it, there has nothing significant has happened to comic books.
What?
That can create a new age.
Yeah, you're probably right about that.
Except for maybe the crossover in popularity to television and
other
movies.
Mediums,
so, I think you're right in calling it probably the postmodern age of comics, because really, comic books are no longer just a singular medium.
Mm.
You know, we are in a postmodern age where comic books, you write a comic book and you have a very good chance of having it picked up to become a television series, a movie.
They're synonymous with
a series of action figures, a throw blanket, Spaceballs the flamethrower.
Yeah, right.
You know?
Yeah, no.
The titties love this one.
As far as ages, though, you don't really think about it until like 10 years later.
Yeah.
So, I mean, when Watchmen came out, nobody thought that was the beginning of the modern age. It's just the same. Mm-hmm. So, you know, within 5 more years, they might divide that up to the postmodern age at a certain point.
I'm surprised that
you heard it here first, folks.
Yeah. I'm surprised nobody's done a book. Well, you couldn't do it, you know, but it would be stupid, again, in a way. But instead of doing the Watchmen, do the same book with the Charlton superheroes, not calling them, you know, blah 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 and blah blah blah, just having them be their own characters and see
what. Called Smotchman.
Yeah, right. You know. Yeah,
just know. Call them not Watchmen.
Because DC doesn't do. I don't know. Maybe I'm wrong. Do they do much with those characters? I mean, Blue Beetle's been like, you know, remade.
They tried, but the Blue Beetle they brought back.
That was definitely their most successful Charlton character, I think.
But yeah. All the other ones are just like, you know, every once in a while they come up with a new line. Oh, it's the whatever line, you know, the new line of some Charlton superheroes. And
well, wasn't Dr. Fate one of the Charlton?
No, he was always DC.
Was he? Okay.
That was a Golden Age character, wasn't he?
Yeah, Dr. Fate was Golden Age.
He's one of my favorite characters, and I love those old stories. I love what Al said. I love those backup stories they used to do in the back of the DC books in the early 70s. I love the Golden Age stories. To me, they were just a thrill. It was always a guy protecting the neighborhood. You know, you know, usually it was kids, like the Guardian. There's a bunch of kids around.
Yeah.
You know, it was a cop that had to beat, and he couldn't, kind of like Batman, he couldn't follow the law all the time at night, so he'd put on that, you know, blue and gold costume and fight. Mr. Terrific, same way. I absolutely love those Robot Man.
It was jarring to see, like, say in the front of the book, there's a new Alex Toth story. Beautiful design, Batman, the costume becomes the logo, blah, blah, blah. And then at the end, you go to the back of the book, and there's another Alex Toth story, and it looks like cut-rate Milton Caniff, and you're going like, what? This is, can't be the same guy, and it's...
And then you realize it's like generations apart.
Oh,
you know?
No.
I was a younger age, you know, so when Al, he had a refined taste. I got that way when I was around that age. But as a kid, I'd pick up Green Lantern. The Neil Adams cover would catch me. The stories I found is nothing but just, you know, drug-addled idiots and depressing and hurtful. You know, and I was like 9 and 10 years old. I'm like, well, this is sucking. Oh, wait, all of a sudden there's a happy Gil Kane Green Lantern story in the back. Well, this is awesome.
Nice.
So, you know, you had to deal with the first 16, 18 pages of nothing but horrendous depression. And then you're happy again.
Yeah, man. You know, speaking of artists changing, I was going through some books, and I'm finding all these old books, old, I mean, by the 90s. And I go, well, let's see, do I keep this? Let me see who drew this. Oh my god, I found some early art by Charlie Adlard that he did. I forgot what book it was. It was horrible. And then I found some books that were drawn by Steve Epting, who became like a great artist. I go, they're horrible. It was like, wow, this is in John Paul Leon. It's funny how these guys started. And
I've never seen anything from Charlie Adlard except Walking Dead.
I'll see if I can find it. No, it's from the 90s. It was bad. Whatever. Relatively bad compared to, you know, what he became. But it's funny how good these guys got in whatever amount of time. I don't know how long it took, but, you know.
I mean, it'll happen to a comic artist pretty quickly because you think about it, man. When your output is almost a page a day, basically, or if you're putting out 20 pages a month, you know, you're going to get better because you're doing the same thing over and over.
Does it happen with writers? Get better?
Yeah, I'm assuming yes.
And sometimes worse.
You get better at pacing, you get better at constructing a story. I would think so, yeah.
I mean, I can't say all writers get better.
Yeah.
Just like all artists don't get better. I'm just saying, in general, though,
yeah,
if you're doing the same thing
over and
over.
The thought process is that you should, if you are doing the same thing over and over again, repetition creates practice, creates
competency.
You know, yeah, exactly. That's
so what are you saying, writers get lazy? Maybe that's why they don't get better?
I don't know if they get lazy or if they run out of ideas.
They repeat the same storyline or something.
Well, it's a level of interest. Are they really interested in what they're doing? Because you start going through the motions.
Well, once you've told your story, you've told your story. Yeah. What more is there to write? But you're being told you're contracted for X amount of books.
And that's why some of the best series are, you know, have a defined beginning, middle, and end.
Yeah.
For instance, Lock and Key, which is actually a really long series, that's a total of maybe 36 issues or something like that. Mm-hmm. That's got a beginning, middle, and end, and that's a long time to keep interest.
That's a perfect
book.
But if you
Joe Hill constantly kept that.
Walking Dead
going.
Is at like issue 160 something. Okay? You know? How freaking long is he gonna carry this out? He says he has an end game in mind. How long is it gonna take to get there, dude? Or have you just seen that this thing is a money generator and you're just telling everybody, it's gonna end eventually.
Yeah. Well, it's probably a good thing he has an end game because who knows if the comic will outlive the show? I would assume so because a lot of those guys, their contracts are coming up. Plus, the ratings on the show have been incredibly low this season, but that's all relative because the ratings of Walking Dead, even their low ratings are probably better than high ratings of other shows.
Everything been down this year. I think they're not counting the way people watch stuff anymore.
I don't know.
No, they can't. They can't because it's so fragmented.
They're saying football.
Yeah, because a lot of people DVR it. A lot of people watch it in different formats.
Yeah, they say football's down. That they can't. Apparently, they can't count the ratings of people who watch it on DVR.
Oh, which is a huge portion of cable watchers.
Not to mention, you get people, you know, that are streaming. Yes. You know. Yeah.
On demand.
On demand stuff, DVR, streaming it, you know, downloading it. You know, the cable industry has to change, just like the music industry did. You know, they need to realize that people are no longer willing to pay packages the way that they used to.
Yeah, but they're trying. That's what gets me is like a new Star Trek show that's supposed to come out on CBS.
Mm-hmm.
What I'm told is supposed to show the pilot on CBS, and then you have to pay for their streaming program or something.
Yeah.
And when somebody at work was talking about it, you know, I'm not getting it. Well, it's only $5 a month. Well, how many $5 a month, you know, things are there out there?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I'm not going to get any of them. I don't watch that much TV.
But not to mention, I'm not paying $5 a month just for one network.
Yeah.
You know, so it's ludicrous, you know.
Well, and that's the thing though, I think a lot of networks and a lot of cable companies, they realize the problem, and so everybody's scrambling with different ideas, and so you've got all these ideas that most of them aren't going to stand the test of time. Most of them are going to fail. The CBS $5 a month, that whole model, it's probably not going to last past a few years, you know.
Yeah, who knows?
They're just trying to find, in general, trying to find their footing.
Well, HBO finally put HBO Go up for individual purchase.
That's right, because before...
You can purchase just the HBO Go package, and you can stream HBO Go like that.
Because in the past, you
cable package.
Yeah, in the past, you had to subscribe to HBO with your cable package in order to get HBO Go. But now, yeah, it's called something different. It's HBO Now, I think it's called.
I don't know what it's called. But
anyway, yeah, it's separate. It's like a Netflix or a Hulu kind of thing where you can just go and get it.
Yeah.
My
friend just subscribed to Sirius Radio because they've got some deal where it's like $5 a month for 6 months. You don't get Howard Stern, but you get all their...
Which I don't understand. I have a satellite radio in my work vehicle. I don't use it.
You don't listen to it?
I listen to terrestrial. Yeah, because quite frankly... If what I found, okay, because around the election time, I was listening to some of the different news outlets. What I found was the same crap they're pushing over the Sirius satellite is the stuff that they're streaming on some of the radio apps that I have on my phone for free.
Oh, okay.
So why am I paying for my boss is paying for it because he likes to have radio wherever he goes, and he likes the Elvis channel. So, he's a huge Elvis fan.
I like your boss. I never met him, but I like him already.
So that's what he has Sirius. But to me, I don't understand what it's worth. It's
I don't
not
either.
Worth
my friend goes, well, I like to listen to like the 60s channel, and the radio down in Miami sucks, and it's not that great here either. And I'm going like, he goes, it's only $5. I go, yeah, it's $5, but you're not even getting the whole package, you know? I mean, it's going to be done in 6 months.
Terrestrial radio here in this area is garbage. It's absolute garbage.
It is garbage.
That's why I listen to mostly internet streaming radio. So.
Yeah, but he wants to listen to it in his car, so I guess that's what the deal is or whatever. I don't get it. You know, yeah. I wouldn't do it. I wouldn't do it at all. You know, it's like, nah, it's all right. Oh, okay, break time.
All right, well, yeah, it's about that time. We're about another...
Speaking of music.
Exactly. If I wasn't so clumsy verbally, I would have segued that really well. Anyway, we're going to take a quick music break. We're going to come back, and we've got a couple exciting little things to talk about, all comic book related, I promise you.
Softly whisper, through a frail voice, she says, it doesn't matter, I know pain.
You can hear our most recent 20 episodes on iTunes. If you would like to hear our older episodes, you can find them on our blog. Just go to bunchofdorks.com and click on the Cyclops.
That was Groovy Cool. They were a local band here in the 80s, but no more.
Who's in the band?
Our friend Ron Ray, who's the bassist.
Yeah, he works at the Widget Factory with us.
The Widget Factory.
Hey, Al, you know what time it is?
Howdy Doody time?
Nope.
It's clobbering time.
No.
Dinner time?
Uh-uh.
I don't know.
Pullapalooza!
All right. So here we are. Once again, we're doing Pullapalooza, and we've got all four of us here. So Don's got Rook stack. Al's got Don stack. I've got Al stack, and Rook's got my stack.
Rook, you start us off, man.
All right, baby. Let's see here. We'll pull from the magic stack of Dallas, and... There we go. An Oriental Heroes issue.
Oh my god.
Oh, that's a good one. That's number 19.
Those are your beginnings.
Yes. Oriental Heroes.
Yes.
Jade Man Comics, issue 19.
Alright.
Now, this is a book. Rook and I got into Jade Man Comics around the same time, probably the late 80s, early 90s, okay? It was a comic company originally out of Thailand.
Hong Kong, I thought.
Hong Kong. Listen to Don. So anyway, they had a few different titles, right? Rook subscribed to The Blood Sword, which is awesome. My buddy Pete subscribed to The Drunken Fist. Is that what it's called? Drunken Fist. And I subscribed to Oriental Heroes, which is basically a kung fu soap opera. You know, it was a serialized book. Right. The cool thing, so the guy that created and wrote and did most of the breakdowns was Tony Wong, who created the company. Anyway, the cool thing is he had like a team of ghost artists that would go in and detail all of his breakdowns.
But it wasn't what people thought, where it'd be like an assembly line. It was an assembly line, but not like in American comics, where one guy with pencil and one guy with ink and one guy with color. They had people that specialized in shading on muscle sinew.
Yeah, like, and if you look in here, and I remember being, even at a young age, shocked at the detail and how consistent the art was.
Yeah.
And now you can understand why, because they had one guy doing the muscle shading, one guy probably doing the hair. Like, it was bananas, man. Like, the art was fantastic. The books all lasted for quite a few years in America. I think there were 54 or 55 issues of Oriental Heroes, and that was their flagship title.
Now, what was it that attracted you to that, as opposed to, like, you know, X-Men or something like that?
You know, for me, it was the Jade Man Primer, which they released a book from Jaman Comics that had just a preview of all the number ones that they were releasing. And I got it, I think, old Jim Johnson, our buddy that used to own the comic book shop that we go to, I think he was giving them out for free, or at least he gave me one for free. And being a kid, getting a free comic and reading it, I read it 10 times, you know, in a week probably. I got hooked, and I started getting Oriental Heroes. And I'm pretty sure probably the same thing happened with Rook and Bloodsword.
No, actually, my Jade Man comics were because of you and this book. You handed me one of yours, and I instantly fell in love, being that I studied martial arts at the time as well.
You're welcome.
It was very different from what we were used to seeing. The way that they colored pages, the movement of motion,
the quality of the paper, I remember is
it's just basic paper.
Yeah,
it's just,
never mind,
like almost basic newspaper.
But they were like 64 page issues each one.
They were big chunky issues. Yeah. I mean, it was, and almost every issue was action packed. You know. It was
like more action than you would see in an American mainstream comic or whatever we were reading at the time. Like, it was
the characters
very intense.
Were very different than what we were used to as American comic book readers. So it was fun. It was definitely definitely something different than what we're used to.
How long did your interest in these go for?
Mine went. Okay, very funny story. So I think I said issue 55, let's say, was the final issue. I cut off, not knowing the series was going to end, I cut off my subscription with Jim Johnson at issue 54. No lie. And then I read issue 54, and I for some reason, I waited a few months to read it because I had a backlog of a bunch of comics. I read it, and I saw it said next issue, the final issue. And I was like, crap. And I asked Jim to get the final issue for me, and he was never able to order it. So I have the majority of the run. Except the final issue.
Wow, you guys are like, you know.
You should have wrote it down. Wilson's, I don't know if they still do, but they had a box.
They had a box of Asian comic books there.
Yeah, oh.
The Jademan books.
There you go. There's actually, I'll write down all the issues I still need. Yeah. That'll be awesome.
I also remember the funny thing about Jademan comics is that, what was his name again? Tommy Wong?
Tony Wong.
Tony Wong. He had this larger-than-life persona that he put on in the books. Like, there was, like, a fold-out in one of the books where it was, like, him leaning on, like, a Lamborghini or something
that. That's what
that.
I remember. Yeah,
there it is. I'm looking at it right now.
Totally right there.
That's what I remember.
Right there.
Yeah.
He's like, hey,
look at that crap.
You see, like, the Hong Kong, like, cityscape in the background.
And he's just waving at you like, hey, I'm awesome.
Oh, it's awesome.
Yeah.
And it's got the history of Tony Wong. There's like on the other side of this pull-out poster, it's got where he was born and where he went to school. It's so funny.
That thing was,
He was the Asian Stan Lee.
Yes.
You know?
There's a painted portrait of him in here.
Look at like glamour shots. That was a promotion for the company. A lot of companies I work for, they have the history of the company and who started it. You know, I bought that same issue.
I remember these.
I kept hearing about these things. You know, I was kind of interested. Mike Barron, you know, wrote Probably dialogued them.
Yes, Mike Barron was dialoguing them, and I'm assuming someone else did the translation.
Right.
But I'll tell you, the translation was absolutely horrible. Do you remember, Rook?
Oh God, like, yeah.
First off,
like, you had such a hard time reading some of these.
Yeah, because a lot of the sentences wouldn't make sense. Right. Sometimes the dialogue was duplicated in a second word balloon, which made no sense. And of course, looking in Hong Kong and a lot of Eastern countries, you read from right to left.
Right.
So sometimes the panels would be misplaced or the dialogue would still be right to left, and it was confusing as hell.
But Mike Barron,
I'm sorry, go ahead.
Well, Mike Barron was saying that the reason he was interested was all the martial arts poses were right on the money. The stances, the forms, he said, I've never seen that, and he wanted to do it. So when this came out, I bought that sampler. And there was two things. It has irritated me that it didn't make sense as far as I was concerned. They were calling everybody little brother and stuff like that. And I kept thinking, if this is an Asian comic, why are there so many blonde-haired people in it? And the other issue was, it's like you got each story was like 3 or 4 pages, and there was another one, and I don't know. It was like not scratching the surface. They weren't telling anything. They were just jumping around a lot. And in the center of the book, that little pamphlet, it's like, again, companies, if you work for Coca-Cola, they have a little cartoon story of how Coca-Cola started, all their successes. But it's about Tony Wong. He had a whole thing about how he tried to start a company before and it went out of business. He tried this one, and he finally found out martial arts comics sold. And they had pictures of him drawing. I'm thinking, okay. And then the Lamborghini picture. Really? Really? And, I never bought another one. I was surprised. There was a big thing in Comics Journal because a bunch of distributors bought stock in the company.
And Jade Man?
And Jade Man, and a lot of distributors and, you know, different comics movers and shakers. And Gary Groth is going after them, you know, right to the jugular. And they were saying, listen, I bought the stock. We met with Tony Wong. We're going to bring the comics over. I bought the stock. If you want it, you can have it. I just did it on good faith, and it's only worth $2. But they were saying it's like strange bedfellows, like, you know, it's a conspiracy. Hmm. The store, I went back home to Oklahoma at one point, and I was asking the guy at the store, do you sell those? He said, well, he sold them a little bit, but he said he doesn't carry them on the stands anymore. He said, but there's a woman that reads every single one of their books, which I think they must have had like 8 or 16 or something, but he said she's crazy about them. She came in every week to get those books, and she read them. Like I said, it's one of these things, like, you know, we're talking about Golden Age stories. They tickled my fancy. They didn't tickle yours.
You know, it is funny because they marketed the heck out of it at first. And like I said, these primers, they were practically giving them away everywhere you saw. But when I was working at a local comic shop when I was 19 years old or so, I only worked there for about a year, but only once did I have a customer come in and ask if we had any Jademan comics.
Yeah.
I was elated. I was like pouring through back issues with him, looking for
like,
the
this
books
is a great
he
issue, man.
Yeah,
fight, man. Yeah.
Well, I think that company went under.
It
was I don't know, sometime in the late '80s. Well, it was the late '80s, but maybe the '90s. They said Tony Wong's company was kind of going. It's having trouble. Which, reading that pamphlet, you wouldn't have thought so. But anyway.
Yeah, I mean, when I worked at the company, we had them, but like I said, every once in a while, one guy would look for one, but it was like, I don't know
how
they sold. They must have sold in certain areas, like maybe more Asian-centric areas or whatever, but in everywhere else, it was like, we had them.
I'm guessing they did so well in Hong Kong. Oh, sorry, Don, did you? They did so well in Hong Kong that they probably had enough capital to keep it going in America for a while, even if they weren't selling.
Now, did you guys watch the, were you guys also watching the Kung Fu movies and stuff like that? The martial arts theater on TV or anything like that?
Oh, yeah,
absolutely.
Oh, there you go. Okay, that was part of the whole deal, too, then. Yeah, you had the Kung Fu culture there going on or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, like I said, we had them, too, man. It was just like, oh, okay, yeah, we got actual Oriental heroes. I don't remember seeing maybe one or two people ever bought them, but it was kind of funny, though. It was like, okay, and then when you guys were... You were really into them. I'm going like, wow, you guys are really into them.
We were that age, man. It captured our imagination or our love of Kung Fu.
Yeah.
Or martial arts in particular.
Yeah, there you go. Right on, man.
All
right,
moving right along.
Go ahead.
All right. I'll go. Pulling from Al's pile. Oof. Listen to that. Listen to those juicy, awesome books. What do I got here?
Oh, one of my favorites.
Here we go. This is The Inferior Five, number 4, 12-cent cover. Looks flippin' awesome. I've only seen Inferior Five through Al. I forget when we were talking about it, but I'm pretty sure we were talking about it on the show at one point.
Yeah, we did.
So, this issue...
Are they spoofing the FF on this one or something?
It kind of looks like it. It's called Valhalla Blue. But anyway, it's... I was going to tell you who it's written and drawn by, but
Joe Orlando's the artist.
Drawn by the awesome Joe Orlando.
And maybe Arnold Drake is the writer. I'm not 100% sure.
But either way, it's great. And yeah, you want to tell us about Inferior Five?
You know, all I know about them is it was started out as like a joke. It was like it was a satire book. And a lot of times what they were basically satirizing was like Marvel. Because there's one issue where the Hulk's in it and like, you know, all these other like, and there's a Mr. Fantastic. I go, I'm like, how are they getting away with this? And isn't Marvel going to sue them? But I guess since they were just goofing on them, you know, and DC did a lot of those books from the era, which is kind of a cool thing that they did. They had the Jerry Lewis books, the Bob Hope books that were very nice by Bob Oxner and all them. And they had unusual comic books back then. Yeah. People kind of, everybody thinks of, well, the Superman, Mr. You know, Boring and whatever, and Batman or whatever. But they're putting out some strange books, and that's definitely one of them. You know,
that's awesome.
Like, I remember buying them off at Sands as a kid because they were like, oh, wow, these look like, you know. And then I read them, and I'm going like, wow, this is kind of goofy, you know, kind of like Mad or something, you know, but yeah. Hullabaloo was, I don't know if this is a whole, oh, it's like a takeoff on Thor.
Yeah, that's right, yeah. It is, because Valhalla Baloo, and yeah, the guy in the cover looks like Thor a little bit. So we'll post pictures on the site.
Oh, my favorite one was the one where they screw around with the Fantastic Four. That's hilarious as all get out. The cover is not by Joe Orlando, though, I don't think. It's by Sikowski or somebody like that. I'll take a look at it. Maybe it is Mike Sikowski.
Oh, it looks really nice.
I think it is Mike Sikowski. Yeah. No, it's Joe Orlando.
So what era is that? Is that the 66, 60s, you said?
67 or whatever. Oh, it's almost like their version of...
This is 67.
Mad Magazine kind of stuff, too, whatever. I mean, after this came out, Marvel started doing a book called Not Brand Eck, which is they make fun of their own characters, which is kind of like a Mad.
Well, they made fun of Superman in one of them.
Did they make fun of Superman or whatever? They had like a Irving Forbush was the Wayne guy or whatever. You know?
What book was Super Duperman in? Was that Mad Magazine? Super Duperman.
So it was like a version of like Mad or whatever. And Joe Orlando was an EC artist, so you know he definitely would have. But yeah, Dumb Bunny and like you know and. I guess they were making fun of themselves, too, in a way. You know,
my first introduction to Joe Orlando was through Watchmen, because the Tales from the Black Frighter was supposed to be based on, like, Joe Orlando.
Yeah.
His type of
art. Yeah.
Yeah.
His style of art.
You know, Super Duper Man, you mentioned it. You know what was inspired from that?
What?
You just mentioned it.
Well, I'm looking at the comics.
No, Dallas.
Watchmen?
Watchmen.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Alan Moore the idea when he's... Because Super Duper Man was in, you know, Mad Magazine, and he was a clerk at a supermarket, just a nerdy clerk. He was in love with Lois Bent, or Lois, I can't remember her name, but it was Lois. She worked there, she was really hot, she didn't care anything about him. He was always getting chastised by his boss, and then when he turned to Super Duper Man, you know, he was awesome, she was in love with him.
Kind of like Night Owl.
Yeah,
right?
And... You know, Alan Moore read that, and that's what he started thinking about superheroes in real life. And that's where Watchmen came from, which I never would have thought.
That's awesome. I never knew that.
Well, wasn't Watchmen supposed to be originally, like, somebody told Alan Moore to write a story about the Charlton superheroes? Or that?
No,
Alan Moore
wanted to.
He wanted to. Okay, it wasn't an assignment. He wanted
Those
to.
Were the characters he was going to use to tell
his
story.
But they didn't want him to destroy all the characters.
Originally, they were going to. Yeah. It was supposed to be the Charlton characters. But then as the project went on, and they started realizing what he was going to do with them, they said, why don't you just make up your own? I think Len Wein was the one who suggested that.
And I think it's a great idea because the characters are much more endearing, I think.
Well, and like I said, you could tell where they came from, but they were absolutely, you know, their own thing. And then he made Rorschach, you know, completely, you know, Steve Ditko thinking to the end.
My turn.
All right, Al. You're up, buddy.
Let's go. Okay, let's go. I'll take this one. Donald Duck Adventures. Yeah, there you go, number 7. Okay, now we're going to go through all the good old age-old My Dilemma.
Gladstone Comics.
Gladstone Comics. I'm assuming this is by Carl Barks.
Absolutely.
I cannot tell. I am like,
if it's a Donald Duck book and Don owns it, it's Carl Barks.
And that's one of my favorites right there, because it's a mystery of the swamp, and he's in the Florida Everglades.
Oh, Florida, yeah.
And he, Donald Duck, they're camping with his nephews. I think they're one of those fan boats or whatever.
Yeah.
But they're camping, and they wake up, and all their equipment keeps disappearing. And they finally catch these culprits, because they're stuck. And I think they're called the Geezels. I can't remember the name.
I'll see if I can find it.
But
like Dr. Seuss?
Well, they had a name, but what was funny, they're little creatures, the little kind of like aquatic ears.
Like these guys
and
here.
And webbed hands, yeah.
Yeah, like little submariners.
But they spoke like hillbillies. They dressed like hillbillies.
Check it out.
And when you take them to their main camp, they had this giant carved idol like a Mayan ruin, and they play square dance records. They say the thing is going to talk to you. Well, the leader of this group of people, creatures, he played this old phonograph, and it was square dancing. Everybody starts square dancing. And then, of course, the ducks start figuring out what was going on. They go up inside the statue and call out things, and then they escape. And
only Carl Barks, man.
Only Carl Barks. If you want to read great comic books, he is, to me, the greatest writer-artist that comics ever saw. And, you know, sometimes you say, oh, Donald Duck, Disney, I don't like them. You'll like these. They're fun, the stories are great, and I'm still, you know, collecting old stories that they did. I have never read every one of them, and never stopped. The Uncle Scrooge stories are always my favorite, but this is... The Donald Duck stories are just nothing but greatness, but he never got old. And who would have thought of little creatures being hillbillies, you know?
I'm the swellinest sweller that ever swelt.
Well, the Donald Duck animated features or whatever, they were... DuckTales, but before DuckTales, the ones from like the 40s or whatever, they were... He really added a lot of weight to all the characters. Oh, yeah. Donald Duck was just like...
Yeah, and he took Uncle Scrooge and made him his own. Did he create...
Yeah, he created Uncle Scrooge and all that stuff.
He created all the ducks in there. Donald Duck and the nephews, Huey, Dewey, and Louie, and I think Daisy Duck were already around. All the others, the Beagle Boys, you know, there was always a nemesis. Gyro Gearloose, Uncle Scrooge, Gladstone Gander. They all were Carl Barks. There was countless others.
When I was very young...
Duck.
When I was very young, like probably when I first met Rook, I used to read Walt Disney's comics and stories, and I had a bunch of them. I don't have many anymore, and I don't know if there were any Carl Barks stories in there, but I used to love them when I was like seven.
One or two, maybe.
I imagine this is where that came from.
Because that's a reprint right there, right? Yeah. So I see a cover price of $1.
Gladstone were printing these up in the 80s. They got the license, and they were really good about telling you where they got these stories.
Yeah, isn't it right?
Yeah, I can't find it as I'm talking here, but in 1948. No, it's not 19. Anyway, this issue's credits. It didn't say where it came from. Oh, well. One thing I know they were having problems with back then was people would request stories, and they'd always go by title, which, you know, is what I would have done. And they said, look, this is the stories that they got aren't listed by titles, they're numbers. If you can find a story number, because I guess they always had a serial number at the bottom, and you need to give that to them and they'd reprint it. Because these weren't printed in order.
Hmm.
But that's absolutely one of my favorite ones.
There's a story and it says, Donald Duck in 1071, written, drawn, lettered, and colored by William Van Horn. So there's another...
That's in the back.
That's in the back, yeah, but it was all... It says here, Mike Royer... was involved in this. The front cover concept, additional background, special effects and inking by Mike Royer. Wow. Art by Dan Gippies, which I guess was a Swedish artist.
Yeah, he was one of the... He did a lot of covers. He was a duck artist in Europe. Donald Duck, all the Disney stuff, Mickey Mouse, Donald Duck, they're huge in Norway, Netherlands, and all of Europe. And they have their own artists.
Hmm.
Yeah, it's still going strong. Whereas here, we always look back at Carl Barks.
Well, he did all of them, basically.
He was the master. Yeah, Carl Barks, I mean, everything else you're ever going to do, it's just going to be based off of Carl Barks.
There you go. Not Carl Marx, but Carl Barks. Carl Barks, different guy. Anyway.
And Dallas Walker.
And it's your
turn. Oh, it's my turn. That's
it's
right.
Your turn.
I'm waiting for Dallas. All right, I'm going to pull right straight from the bottom. This better be a good one, Roy.
I have no idea.
Hack Slash.
Oh, all right. Let's take a look, see which issue
now,
this
one
is.
Thing, I'm familiar with the name because I hear Hack Slash all the time. I've never touched a book. I've never looked at it.
Hack Slash is a basic concept of, her name is Casey Hack. And what she does is she goes out, she hunts down these basically movie slashers, you know.
Serial killers?
Nope, slashers, not serial killers. Slashers are the killers that keep coming back to life.
Oh,
like your
Michael
Jasons,
Myers.
Your Freddies, your Michael Myers. So she's the one who hunts them down and puts them in the ground permanently. She has a lovely assistant named Vlad, who is a giant, misshapen, misformed gentleman, who she originally mistook as a slasher. So, for a while, Hack Slash was actually supposed to be getting a movie or TV series, and
yeah.
I don't know whatever happened with that. So,
you know, I have to admit, the art style and the interior threw me, because it's really cartoony.
Here's the funny thing. Different stories, different artists.
Are you serious?
Yes. There's a lot of different... Hack Slash had a lot of different things going on in its runs. It's over now, unless they do yet another run. But, yeah, different different artists have done different things with the Casey Hack character over the years. This particular issue is number 27 from Devil's Due Press. And oh yes, this is a much more cartoony one than some of the others. So
almost reminds me of who's the guy, Don, that you like that did the Batman animated
Bruce
series?
Bruce Timm, that's what I was thinking.
Bruce yeah. Timm, yeah.
Yeah, see in the back here you'll see some of the other style art of what Casey Hack and Vlad look like. So it's not always this cartoony in the Hack Slash series. So, you know, it just, like I said, different artists, different storylines, ends up with different things going on in them. So,
what's funny is when you're describing the book, when I was looking at it, every time I heard Hack Slash, I thought it was a Japanese anime show about people doing code.
There is actually there is another one. That's what you're thinking of.
Oh, that's hilarious.
Yeah, but I mean, Hack Slash, because you're writing the code, you always have to put the
slash.
Hack
Backslash.
Yeah.
That's what you're thinking of.
That's
so, yes, there is one like that, but this is Hack Slash, the Devil's Due Press series.
So they came up with new slashers.
They came up with new slashers.
Oh, okay.
Her mother was a slasher.
Your mother was a slasher.
Her mother was the lunch lady. Who was chopping up and cooking and serving the kids that made fun of her daughter.
Oh, boy.
Instead of being caught, she stuck her head into a boiling vat of soup or something.
Blech.
And then came...
This is a humorous book. I'm darkly humorous.
So, some of it is quite humorous.
Black humor.
Very black. And then she comes back from the dead and continues her murderous spree. There's actually some of the stuff in the book takes place right here in Tampa, Florida. One of Casey's love interests is from Florida, a stripper from Florida.
There you go. One of the many.
Can't have anything happen in Florida without having strippers involved.
Right.
Tampa, Florida. So, anyway, yeah.
Awesome, guys. That's Pulpalooza.
That's Pulpalooza.
Pulpalooza.
Yeah, freaking sweet. Yeah.
You want to talk
already?
About, you want to talk about it's, Steve?
Yeah. Okay. So here's the thing. Usually, when I'm host on the show, I'm usually kind of a stickler for time, and you know, I like to keep it around an hour. We'll run a little over because we do have a book we still want to talk about. That's cool.
Yeah,
guys.
Dallas was telling me he hasn't been reading anything, but he's read the first 20 pages of
40 pages.
Oh, 40. I'm sorry.
the world of Steve Ditko, which is a biography on. The amazing Steve Ditko. It's a really nice hardcover. Don brought the physical copy, so we can kind of look through it and check it out. But I enjoyed it. Now, personally, I don't have a lot of... I don't know about Steve Ditko. I don't have a big history with him. The only things that I know he ever did was, of course, The Amazing Spider-Man and The Question. I didn't really read any of The Question stuff, but I do have...
Doctor Strange?
I never read Doctor Strange.
You never read Doctor Strange?
But I have the first Amazing Spider-Man omnibus, which is all Steve Ditko, which is great. No, I didn't see the movie. But anyway, so yeah, this is a really enlightening book. It was cool to see kind of his early work, where he got his start and whatnot. Like I said, I'm only like a quarter of the way into the book, but it's really entertaining. If anything, it's really given me a great appreciation for the guy and what he does and his inspirations.
He took it to a different... level, with his, whatever you want to call it, his philosophies and his worldviews and his characters. He kind of like changed comic books along with Kirby a lot, you know? I mean, he's got that style, that Kubert-like style or whatever that he kind of like, you know?
Yeah, I was saying in the book, too, like his early work was often confused with Joe Kubert.
Yeah, it was definitely influenced, but he took it to another level. And I mean, he basically was the quirky, kind of, well, not the quirky, one of the quirky guys, but Spider-Man would have been way different if Jack Kirby would have done it.
Oh, yeah. Completely different animal.
Well, that was the thing. I'd always seen Steve Ditko when I was growing up. But I was shocked. When I started, I discovered Spider-Man from the TV show, you know, with the 60s animated Saturday morning show. I started reading Spider-Man when Ross Andrew was the artist. I read a few of the Romitas before that, but not often, but I started collecting Spider-Man comics in the early 70s, and Ross Andrew was the artist. Well, the first time I'd ever seen a Steve Ditko Spider-Man was, besides spot illustrations and covers and stuff, it's when I picked up that Marvel Treasury edition. The first one was, you know, Spider-Man.
Oh, yeah.
And the first story was the Green Goblin, you know, and I guess they had that, he had that crew. They were in a cave and fought Spider-Man, the Enforcers, I think it was. And I was kind of surprised at how odd, cartoony, kind of crude, and sissy everything looked. You know, the Green Goblin had those big eyes with the eyelashes. And,
yeah.
You know, Spider-Man was skinny, you know. I still liked it, but I was really surprised. And the Doctor Strange work, I used to, an older kid had some of those issues. I was reading them. When I was a kid, I did not like Doctor Strange. He looked like, they used to have billboards for an alcohol, some type of liquor in Texas. And there was a guy in a suit with his weathered face, you know, brushed back hair, kind of like David Niven or something. And he was always advertising liquor. And every time I saw that, I thought of Doctor Strange. Doctor Strange looked like that. He just looked like a sinister guy you couldn't trust.
Well, he kind of is.
Yeah.
I mean...
But when I was reading those old Steve Ditko stories, these are creepy. Well, when I was in high school, I was buying all these reprints. The Steve Ditko Doctor Strange work, to me, it's some of my favorites. They're imaginative. Walt Simonson brought up that Steve Ditko was the one that created the language of the vectors, where Doctor Strange, all the powers are coming out, the geometric shapes and, you know, the beams and everything. But All those, you know, different planes of reality you go to, all the stuff Cleo, all the stuff he's doing, the Dormammu, it was just brilliant work. I loved his old, I used to attest these to Jack Kirby, but the old Giant Monster comics that Marvel did before they were Marvel. In the mid-70s, when Marvel was, you know, glutting the market, I was buying all those Creatures on the Loose, Where Monsters Dwell, you know, all those stuff. One of my favorite stories I always thought was Jack Kirby, and it was The Legend of Tim Buba. And the cover, yeah, I know.
What kind of name is that?
Fang Fang Foo.
It's a solid name, okay?
But I imagine that was a Stan Lee invention. But,
sure.
The cover was this giant Jack Kirby-like monster creature with, I think he had fins on his head, but I don't know if it was the actual Steve Ditko work, or they just recovered it, colored it, but it had these brown tone blends, and which is rare. And I thought, wow, this is staggering. And the whole story of Tim Buba, I was just talking about, he was the master of everything, he ruled the world and all that, and it just gone. He had slaves, he had everything else. He was a giant monster that ruled everything. It was kind of like a prose thing. And you're, wow, okay, this guy's invincible. And at the very end of the story, all of a sudden, these things start hitting him. Tim Bubai wonders, what is this? What, don't they know who he is? And it just kept going on. The panel kept shrinking and shrinking, and it was drops of water, giant globs of water hitting him. And the last panel is two boys in the 50s in a bedroom. And one of them says, Tommy, watch out. You're spilling water on my toy globe.
That's funny.
That was awesome. But I was always looking for that, telling guys at the comic store. But I swore it was Jack Kirby. He was Steve Ditko.
You know, it's funny that name. Buba is a character in Cerebus, too. During Church and State, he was one of, when Cerebus was the Pope, he had two of his old mercenary friends, Baron Buba, were like his close bodyguards. And Buba was a really tall, really skinny and lanky guy, done just for comedy relief. He had a Viking hat helmet he always wore, but you couldn't see his eyes, and he was always eating. And like I said, it was just every skit he was in was just all comedy.
Yeah, him and Kirby were like yin and yang, you know what I mean? Yeah, Kirby, you know, and then you had Harry, you know, everybody, and then Ditko's like, oh, you know.
Yeah, Ditko's characters were very, like, frail-looking almost, or at least the Spider-Man stuff was.
Gnarly, weird, you know, Kirby was like godlike, you know.
Yeah, you know. Kirby was granite, and Steve Ditko was more like, you know, withered wood.
Yeah, yeah, it was a great combination, man.
Well, that's what, whenever you talk about, I appreciate the fact now that Marvel Comics is given due to the artist, and it's always Jack Kirby and Steve Ditko. I mean, when I say that.
Among others, too.
Yeah, there were other ones that were great, but it's usually those two that are the ones that created, injected all
the
stuff.
They jump-started the superhero movement.
Yeah. And I'm sure they're getting a little bit of cash, too.
I don't know.
Is Steve Ditko still alive?
Yeah.
He is.
And he doesn't want people bothering him.
I sent you that article, didn't I?
Yeah, I did. That was really good.
Yeah.
They were talking about the guy went to find him. He lives in the YMCA in New York.
But he's got an office in Manhattan, though.
Yeah. He still works, still does.
He lives still does comic work?
Huh?
He lives in the Y in New York?
Yeah, he lives in the YMCA. Wow. And he just lives in real... You know, the thing was, I read one time somebody said Steve Ditko never became what he was against. He's always stayed, you know, regardless of what you want to think about his thinking. How many times have you seen, like, you know, musicians you like or artists you like or even adults you knew... Even yourself, I swore there would be things I'd never do. You know, when I grew up, I'm never going to do this, I'm never going to be like that. And then all of a sudden life hits you and you got to make money, and next thing you know, you have to do some of these
things. Well, Don's hooking on the corner.
No, I'm not talking about that kind of stuff or even being mean to your fellow man, but there's sometimes you find you have to make compromises. You know, it's not just a black and white world. And
except for Steve Ditko.
Well, yeah. But Steve Ditko, he stayed true to his beliefs. And there was one guy, he was an artist, I listened to him on a podcast, and he bought a Steve Ditko piece, you know, an old drawing page. And then he found out that Marvel didn't give him any of the artwork back. They just, you know, it went out to other hands, and this guy paid a pretty penny for it. Well, he got to know Steve Ditko, and when he found out, he told him, I bought that. And Steve did go, yeah, well, you didn't get it from me. They just took it from me. So the artist brought, you know, one day he went up the studio and he brought that artwork back. And Steve Ditko got it. And he goes, okay. And he didn't say a word about it. He just took it, put it aside, and they went about their business. And the guy was like, you know, he didn't offer me anything for it. He didn't say thank you. And he says, but that was his thinking, was... It was his to begin with. Of course, it should go back to him. Which, you know, that's true. But you know, the artist paid money for it, and he was very benevolent in giving it back to him. But that's how Steve Ditko lives. He's still putting his own work out on his own terms. And I've heard 11 o'clock Comics talk about some of that stuff he's been putting out that is good. But somebody said that he's got the sign on the door, Steve Ditko, really easy to find, but he doesn't want people coming to him and
Yeah, there's a quote. In 1969, he says this: when I do a job, it's not my personality that I'm offering the readers, but my artwork. It's not what I like that counts. It's what I did, how well it was done. I produce a product, a comic art story. Steve Ditko is a name, is a brand name.
Yeah, that's how he treats it.
And yeah, they're talking about the BBC documentary that you were talking about that he refused to be filmed, photographed, interviewed. He did give the guys some comic books.
Mm-hmm.
And now one of the guys involved in the documentary says that he has since then spoken with Ditko on the phone and is now on a first name basis with him.
Wow.
Now, see, that's the other thing. I hear people that get to know Steve Ditko, and I guess it was in the early 2000s. I was reading on the internet, it was a Marvel, I don't know if it was a Marvel editor, but he got to know Steve Ditko, and he was in a studio while he's working. And by this time, they were returning artwork. And Steve Ditko was cutting with an X-Acto knife. You know, he's old school, but he was cutting out stuff to paste up. And the guy looked, and he was just using old paper for the cutting board. It was old Spider-Man pages that he drew.
Oh, my God. That's crazy to somebody
and
like
the guy's like, well, what are you doing? And I said, well, I needed something to use this. And the guy's panicking. He says, you could take that and sell it, you know, for a lot of money.
You can buy plenty of whatever you need.
And Steve Ditko's like, why? This is working fine. And he kept going on about it. He could get a mat that cures itself, which is true. You know, there's
mats.
Yeah,
you can get curing, yeah.
Yeah. And he says, as soon as you cut it, it self-cures, and you use it again and again. It works far better than that. This will work. This is what you just read. Steve Ditko looks at it. The work was put out. It was made to be published. And,
all this is byproducts.
Exactly.
Yeah. This isn't worth my time.
Yeah, and when I say this, I don't subscribe to this. But what he's saying is that artwork should be something that's, you know, held in high esteem and, you know, framed and matted and put up on a wall. It should be. But I appreciate what he thinks and what he's saying. But like I said, he stayed true to it. But when you look through this, you see a whole scope. He never stopped. Once he left Marvel, you think that'd be the net?
Oh, he did tons of work.
You know, well, for DC,
he's still working.
Yeah.
He was doing other work for people when he was at Marvel, too, I think.
Yeah, well, you said he was working at Charlton.
I think so, yeah. I think he was doing, like, Captain Atom or something.
Yeah,
like
well, Captain
that.
Atom became Dr. Manhattan. Blue Beetle became Night Owl. Those are terrific. The Question, which is Rorschach. The Question is a fantastic character.
Mm-hmm.
He was on that the Justice League Unlimited cartoon. What was funny was they gave him the Rorschach personality, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, for DC, he did Creeper. He did Hawk and Dove.
Creeper,
Oh, man, the Creeper. Is that green skin dude?
Yeah,
Creeper.
Yellow skin dude.
Yellow.
That guy.
Yeah, that guy.
Who was also in the Batman animated series. He was one of my daughter's favorite characters.
I know him from, I want to say it was the 70s. There was like a short Joker limited series DC released, and there was an issue with the Creeper in it.
So who's Mr. A?
Oh, God.
Now, okay, that was Steve Ditko from Wits End. I've never read these. I've heard of him. And when they did Rorschach, he was based off The Question, but he's also based off Mr. A. Take it away, Mr. L.
You know, objectivism, Ayn Rand.
Yes.
No,
that's
Ayn Rand.
Mr. A is like the superhero or comic book version of her philosophy.
Yeah, because he subscribes to
Black
Ayn Rand's
and white,
philosophy.
You know,
yeah,
only good and bad, you know. He's a crime fighter, and he gets people, and he doesn't have any mercy. You did bad, there's no this, you know, the consequences. That's his life, so, you know, that's what he believes. Even though
The Question is a comic code's acceptable version of Mr. A.
That's it.
And you said the first issue, because we talked about this with Dallas, the first issue was Great Tones, but after that it was always Star Trek.
Yeah, the first one was Great Tones, Black and White, you know.
Yeah.
I got to find some Mr. A.
Yeah.
Alan Moore, when he did Rorschach, he gave him that whole philosophy to the hilt. So if you look at Rorschach, that's exactly what he thinks.
Gotcha.
But there's so many things Steve Ditko did later on for DC. He did Shade the Changing Man.
Yeah, it was
fun. And,
He did stuff for Atlas. Remember Tiger? Was it Tiger Man?
Destructor.
Yeah.
Also for DC in later time, you had Stalker. Wally Wood Inc., which I collected those.
Yeah.
So.
Yep.
I don't know. There's one thing about Steve Ditko is as time went on, it seemed like when he was in Marvel and he's doing Doctor Strange and Spider-Man, it seemed like he was starting to develop more of a refined superhero type look. And then later on, he just seemed like he just threw all out the window and it was all shorthand. He started the odd poses and the super cartoony, stripped down. I hate to say it, it was imaginative, but kind of hacky, you know. And sometimes I look at some of that old Spider-Man work he did before he left. I thought, was this him or was this Romita? And, you know, I always points out that was Steve Ditko. But after a while, he started getting kind of, I don't know, comfortable and lazy with his style.
Which is ironic because just from what I've been reading right now, like, he was the antithesis of that in his earlier career.
It could also be
even when he was making pennies in the dollar working for some of the companies that didn't pay anything, he still put out his best work constantly.
It could be that artistically also his abilities were, you know.
He's getting older, yeah.
I've heard that somebody told me.
I saw you.
Fred Hembeck did a one-page story where he was going and begging Doctor Strange. He wanted to see. He said, "What do you want to see?" He says, "I want to see Steve Ditko." This is in the, I read this in 1980, and Doctor Strange is just blowing him off, and Fred Hembeck's begging him, "I want to see Steve Ditko." When I read it, says, "You know, I've never seen Steve Ditko. What does he look like?" And then finally, at the very end, he pulls out a Polaroid, and it's the Dormammu, you know, the character with the flaming head.
Yeah.
And I was telling Britt when I was in college, you ever seen a picture of Steve Ditko? No. And he brought up the Fred Hembeck thing. He says, in that Marvel Treasury edition, they had a picture. They set up the first two pages like the Daily Bugle, a newspaper. They had pictures of John Romita, you know, drawings that Marie Severin did.
Oh, yeah.
And it had the new Marvel Comics Spider-Man. It had Stan Lee looking, and it had 2 feet jumping out of a window, and that was Steve Ditko. And when they did... DC did that Superman 50th anniversary, whatever it was, comic in 1984. They had a picture in one of the trade publications of all, you know, Frank Miller, Walt Simonson, John Byrne, Howard Chaykin. All the people that did it were at a party. They were all kind of dressed up and had underneath all the captions of who was there, Dave Gibbons and everybody. And it said Steve Ditko asked not to be photographed. So he wasn't in the picture. And so when the internet came up, I looked him up. He looked kind of like an older Peter Parker that he drew.
Really kind of does. Yeah. Looking at this photograph of him, if you see the photograph of him here,
yeah,
looks like an old Pete Parker.
Yeah,
that's so funny.
Now someone is claiming that this is a photograph of him currently.
No,
that's an old. That's from the 60s.
This.
Oh.
That looks like. Doesn't that look like
he's
Jack Kirby?
He's 89 years old.
I wonder. Yeah, it might be.
Could be.
It could be.
I mean, people know where
There's almost no photographs of Steve Ditko.
Well, no. In his case, the reason why is he doesn't believe in that cult of personality. It's what we just said. The work stands on its own. Why do you need to see me? Which, you know, I understand. I mean, I've seen some people that get famous. Bill Watterson was the same way. He didn't want people coming to him, but it was a privacy issue.
Yeah.
But you know, how many rock stars have you seen where they just get sick and tired of people coming to you all the time? So I respect what Steve Ditko did, even though when I got the internet, I did look him up to see what he looked like.
Yeah, there was an old picture of him in an early Marvel yearbook. Yeah. That's from an early Marvel yearbook, I think. One of those pictures. Yeah, like from 63 or something like that. Yeah.
But this book here, Strange and Stranger, the World of Steve Ditko, it's fantastic. And they start explaining about some of the things that set him apart. Like, he used to shadow people's eyeballs. He gave a line underneath it, which I noticed, but I never thought about until I read this. And he's talking about all the worlds he created and what he did. And they don't focus on the sideshow thing that, you know, we were kind of talking about, not making fun of, but we were bringing up that you can't help when you talk to Steve Ditko. But he did a lot of comics that I loved, a lot of comics that completely set the course for what we're reading now. And when I was getting the masterworks for the Fantastic Four, to me, the greatest comics in the world, I thought, you know, the other comics I'd like to get in masterwork form is Steve Ditko's Doctor Strange. But they're hard to find and they're a lot of money. I won't be getting them. But Steve Ditko's Doctor Strange work, to me, is second to none. It's nothing but just color and imagination, unbridled.
There you go.
Yeah, right. I mean, great. Steve Ditko basically set the tone for Doctor Strange for years. I mean, he's the one who gave, you know, all the
like you said, the Elseworldy kind of feelings. And it has been very begged and borrowed upon by other artists to do people like Nightmare and Mephisto and other characters. So he really set a tone with not just that character, but with that genre of Marvel. Mm.
Well, now one thing, Doctor Strange, when they did the first story, Stan Lee posted that Steve brought this to us and said he wanted to put it out. Says, I thought, all right, let's try it. I mean, said Steve.
It was Steve's idea.
Yeah, Doctor Strange was all Steve Ditko, and Stan Lee just said, okay, let's go with it. But, Doctor Strange, even in the 80s, it was a comic I really liked. It was always unique, and now it's kind of, well, it's still around, I guess, in a way. Now they got the movie, but anyway. But anyway, Steve Ditko, it's a great book. Hopefully you can buy it before Dallas finishes reading it. The world of Steve
Ditko. Before I finish reading it. All right, well, that's going to wrap it up for this episode, guys. Thanks for joining us. Hope you enjoyed the episode. What do we got? We got plugs. Anybody want to say anything that hasn't been said before?
Slow Robot.
Yeah, check
YouTube.
Out that.
Bunch of dorks.
Yep.
All right. Cyclops.
All right, guys. Well, thank you for listening. We'll have another episode out in about a week. So until then, take care of yourselves and
read more comics.
You can find Al's other podcast, Slow Robot A Go Go, Dallas's webcomic, The Mighty Blue, and Al's blog, Destination Nightmare, on the sidebar of our blog at bunchofdorks.com.
And click on the Cyclops!